I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
And the author of a number of books about the world of birds. They include Return to Wild America, The Ghost with Trembling Wing, Living on the Wind, which was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize, and Mountains of the Heart. His new book is a history of birding in America titled Of a Feather. He marvels at the, quote, small contained miracle that is a bird. He writes about the skies that were teeming with birds 300 years ago when Europeans arrived. He writes about the first ornithologists, who, of course, were the Indians, the dedicated and eccentric naturalists who identified, shot, and collected birds, the creation of birding societies, and the rise of contemporary bird watching. While birders are growing in numbers, the population of some species are in dramatic decline. Widensaw calls on birders to do more for birds and to do more for habitat conservation. And Scott Widensaw, a great pleasure to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. It's always a pleasure to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. I'd love to have you read from your book.
Yes. Talking here about Miss Jane Hathaway from the Beverly Hillbillies, the tall, mannish spinster played by Nancy Culp, who'd pop up with a pith helmet and a pair of binoculars, so starchy, so prim, so nerdy, though no one used that word in those days, none of which mattered except that she was a birdwatcher, and I knew birdwatchers weren't really like that. Not that I actually knew any birdwatchers, mind you, except for myself, but I'd already suspected I was a pretty odd kid. The whole poking under the logs thing was a tip-off, since most of my friends were much more into football than finding salamanders or garter snakes. Likewise, I was alone in our neighborhood in deciding to tan, with questionable success, the hide of a road-killed woodchuck, or in raising 30 monarch butterfly caterpillars in my room, which smelled of caterpillar droppings for weeks, or, well, the list is a long one. If I'd thought about it, I suppose I would have realized that my bird watching was also a little off-center from what a normal rural Pennsylvania 12-year-old was supposed to be interested in. I hunted and fished and joined the Boy Scouts, like most of my friends, but I just accepted the fact that I liked all things natural, and birds were a big part of that, whether they were chickadees at the feeder or the Cooper's hawk nest I found in the woods behind the house on a stifling June day. My mother intercepted me heading out wearing a heavy winter coat, my dad's work gloves, and my grandfather's hard hat with a stepladder over my shoulder. I was going to shinny up the tree for a peek at the chicks, and I knew I had to protect myself from the adult hawks. I should have considered protecting myself from my mother. Birdwatching was just this pretty cool thing I enjoyed, among a lot of other pretty cool things. Did I mention the ringneck snake that lived under my bed? Then one day I flipped on the Beverly Hillbillies. There was Miss Jane and Professor P. Casper Biddle, actor Wally Cox playing to nerdy type, and their dweeby little friends prancing around in their tweeds and sensible shoes with binoculars around their skinny necks and spectacles perched on their ridiculous faces. I stopped, frozen by the flickering images on that little black-and-white set as the awful truth hit me. Wait a minute, I thought. They're bird watchers. I'm a bird watcher. But they're really, really weird, which means, oh, crap.
And that's Scott Widensaw reading from his new book, and it's called Of a Feather, A History of Birdwatching in America. So you're part of this nerdy club of birdwatchers?
Well, not so nerdy anymore.
Because there are millions of you guys,
yeah,
gals.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of everywhere. I mean, we need some sort of a secret handshake or something. Or maybe we need to start, you know, dressing in really strange clothes and gathering in public places like golf courses so everybody understands how many of this there are. You know, the federal government every couple of years surveys wildlife recreation in the country and comes up with figures in the number of people interested in birds. And the latest figures just out a couple of weeks ago suggest that there are more than 81 million people in the United States interested in birds.
That's now, like 25% of the population.
It is. Now, those are not hardcore birders, obviously. These are not people who, like some of my friends, keep a suitcase packed in their closet so that they can grab it on a moment's notice and jet off to Alaska for the weekend to see a rare bird. This is anybody who puts a feeder up in their backyard, who puts out feeders for hummingbirds, these may be people who can only identify 15 or 20 species of birds, but they're nevertheless people to whom birds are an important part of their life. And as you say, it's a big chunk of the American population.
But it seems so ironic that while we've got this growing interest in the bird population, we've got declining populations of birds.
That's right.
I mean, dramatic in some species.
Indeed. In fact, earlier this year, the National Audubon Society released a report on common birds in decline. These are species like meadowlarks that are, you know, still number in the tens of millions, but whose populations have dropped by 40%, 50%, 70% in the last 40 years or so. And these are the birds that we grew up with. I mean, meadowlarks were the soundtrack of summer when I grew up in the 1960s. And now it's a rare thing for me to hear a meadowlark singing, because we've lost so much farmland habitat, so much grassland habitat. And whether you're talking about whippoorwills or bobwhite quail or this whole suite of birds coming down out of the boreal forests of Canada and the Arctic, where climate change is having an impact on them. You know, these are birds in trouble, and they're a warning sign to us, an alarm that there is trouble in the woods.
Are there bird populations that are growing under today's environment and atmosphere?
Look at Canada geese.
I was going to say, and Canada. I was thinking Canada geese when I asked the question.
Look at Canada geese, wild turkeys. I mean, wild turkeys.
Now, why
are,
is that, do you think?
Well, part of it is because, you know, just by happenstance, some birds are going to have habitat requirements and ecological requirements that match the kind of world that we've created. And Canada geese must think that God is a Canada goose, because you could not create a better world for them. It's like white-tailed deer.
I was going to say, like the deer population.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, we've created this mix of open areas and ponds. You know, office parks are perfect for geese. You have grass that they can graze. You have ponds on which they can rest and nest. They're protected from many natural predators, and so their population has just boomed. But then you have a much larger number of birds, which just because of happenstance, because of the luck of the ecological draw, are not as adaptable. Mm. And so their populations, whether they're birds like wood thrushes and scarlet tanagers that need large areas of unbroken forest, which are being chopped up into smaller fragments, grassland birds like I mentioned, the meadowlark is a good example. I mean, they're probably in the steepest decline. The habitats just aren't there for these birds.
Well, let's roll back the clock a couple of centuries, and you describe, of course, the first, as you write in the book, ornithologists were the American Indians who were here when Europeans arrived, but they described the European settlers who came here in the 1600s, that not surprisingly, the sky is just teeming with birds, and I'm assuming birds that they had never seen in Europe.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the things that struck them was the numbers of birds, the diversity of birds, and also how colorful American birds were in comparison to those in Northern and Western Europe. You know, we have there's a group of Old World birds known as Old World Warblers, and they are as alike as photocopies. They're lovely birds in a subtle way, but they're mostly drab ochres and browns you line them all up and you have a hard time picking one from the other. And you come to North America, where we have an unrelated group of birds, also known as warblers, that are all the colors of the rainbow. Prothonotary warblers that are brilliant, brilliant yellow. Perula warblers with this brilliant orange patch across the face. Blackburnian warblers that look like a tiger, you know, this brilliant orange and black. They look like they'd set the trees on fire. And so they were just, these early Europeans were just gobsmacked by these birds. And you mentioned the sheer numbers of them.
Yeah.
I mean, William Penn wrote about the incredible numbers of waterfowl that came pouring down the Delaware River every fall. Many, many observers talking about the extraordinary numbers of passenger pigeons, which, of course, today are completely extinct. But early naturalists writing about a single flock of passenger pigeons containing several billion birds that took days and days to pass, flying 24 hours a day, this river of birds several miles wide and extending for hundreds and hundreds of miles.
Do you think they were exaggerated? I mean, they were so taken with the landscape and the birds that they just sort of went overboard with their adjectives?
Well, there certainly was some of it. Some, for example, if turkeys keep popping up, right. You know, speaking
huge,
of wild turkeys.
Huge, right?
Yes, they, you know, turkeys of 60 and 70 pounds. Well, no, I don't think so. These were big turkeys. And it, ironically enough, this is a bird that early European colonists were familiar with from Europe, even though it was an American species that the Spanish had picked up. It had been domesticated by Indian cultures in Mesoamerica, taken back to Europe, rapidly overspread Europe as a domestic bird. And so in the 1600s, you have colonists coming here and saying, look at, there are wild turkeys, and wildly overestimating their size, as you say. And it was, you know, don't forget, a lot of the first colonists coming over here were also the first real estate scammers. They were trying to encourage people to move here, so they talked about the temperate climate and the fact that you could grow anything on the soil, and the abundance of birds was part of that. And yet, when you get a little bit later, where you have people like Mark Catesby, who was, you know, one of the first Europeans in the early 1700s to start looking with a scientific eye at birds, these early scientists are confirming those reports that this was not just exaggeration.
And he wrote the first ornithological text, as you write?
Yes. I mean, Catesby was we'd probably call him a slacker today in his youth. You know, he came from a family with some modest means, came to the colonies and spent several years just wandering around, not really doing much of anything with his life. Went back to England, found that the family money was pretty much gone, and he had to do something. And so he became this incredibly focused naturalist, came back to the New World, traveled from Virginia south through Florida and into the Bahamas, collecting specimens, writing about them, painting them, many for the first time. And
beautiful paintings, I would say. I mean, the drawings, I think, are quite stunning.
They really are. I mean, he was the first person to really show an animal with a little bit of its natural habitat. And many of the birds he was painting, like Carolina parakeets and heath hens, are birds that are completely extinct today, passenger pigeons. You know, it was a little glimpse of a vanished world.
Well, and I guess not surprisingly, part of this world, I guess, of naturalists and ornithologists, they shot and collected a lot of birds. I mean, I guess this, before you could look at them through your binoculars, that was one way of looking at them, which was, what, I guess, to shoot them and hold them in your hand?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's something that modern birders, I think, are somewhat aghast at, which is really kind of silly. I mean, think about it. If you're one of the first naturalists exploring to your society, unknown land, and seeing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of varieties of birds, and you have no binoculars, you have no camera, you know, there's no optics at all, the only way to start to understand them is to shoot the bird, collect it, make a specimen skin of it so you have it available for study, to paint it, to measure it. You know, so for the first several hundred years, you know, the subtitle of the book is A Brief History of American Birding. I warned my editor, you know, nobody picks up a pair of binoculars until two-thirds of the way through the book. Before that, it's all shotguns, because it had to be.
Because it had to, and that was the only way that they could really understand, I guess, this natural world.
Sure. I mean, take red-tailed hawks, for example. I mean, so it's a widespread species, but there are as many as 40 different plumage variations in red-tailed hawks. Adults and immatures look different. You have regional subspecies. You have light morph birds. You have dark morph birds. You have some that are russet. And just trying to figure out how they all fit together. Were these different species of hawks? How were they related? You need to have a specimen in your hand.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation and actually open up the phones for our listeners, talking with Scott Weidensahl, our guest today on Radio Times. He's been a guest on the show a number of times, talking about the natural world, talking about the world of birding, and he's got a new book. It's a brief history of American birding, and it's called Of a Feather. He's also a bird bander, and lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments about this history or about birding today, do give us a call. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Focus Features, presenting the new espionage film Lust, Caution, from Ang Lee, the Academy Award-winning director of Brokeback Mountain. Lust, Caution, now in select theaters.
The Executive MBA program at Temple University's Fox School of Business proudly supports WHYY. On Friday, October 19th, and Saturday, October 20th, the Fox Executive MBA program, delivered at the Desmond Conference Center in Malvern, PA, is hosting information sessions. It's an opportunity to meet faculty and staff, to experience the Fox Executive MBA curriculum, and to have your questions answered by current students over lunch. Registration online at fox.temple.edu.
I'm Marty Moscowane, inviting you to be in the audience when Radio Times visits Princeton University on Wednesday, October 24th at 6 p.m. We'll tape a program looking at the state of national politics, and you'll have a chance to ask some of the questions. To reserve your seat for this exclusive WHYY member event, call 215-351-0511 or visit whyy.org. If you're not already a member, you can join today. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Germantown Friends School, authentic Quaker education for boys and girls K-12. Hosting an open house this Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. For details or to RSVP, www.germantownfriends.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Excuse me, I'm Marty Moscowane, and we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499 to talk to our guest, Scott Widensaw. There's some names in here I recognize in your book. Audubon, of course, Bartram Brothers, of course, or John and William Bartram. But there's some people in here, frankly, I hadn't heard of. A woman named Martha Maxwell, who was a collector, and she mounted specimens. You have a photograph in this book of some specimens that she mounted, this amazing diorama of species.
Yeah, in fact, she's the woman who invented the museum diorama, which is something she doesn't get credit for. She was born in Pennsylvania in the 1830s and moved as a young girl to Wisconsin, married a somewhat older man who lost everything in a financial panic, and so they ended up moving to Colorado in, I believe, 1860. He was going to become a gold miner and make his fortune, and he didn't. He was a very bad gold miner. And she basically kept them afloat by running a boarding house and by starting to do taxidermy. And she had a flair for this. And by 1876, when they had the big centennial exposition here in Philadelphia, Colorado's territorial exhibition was Martha Maxwell's, as you said, this enormously complex diorama of, you know, full-size mounted elk and mule deer and leaping cougars and many, many dozens of species of birds with flowing streams through the middle of it. She was also in touch with many of the prominent ornithologists of the day, collecting birds scientifically for them. And in fact, to this day, one of the subspecies of the eastern screech owl is still named Maxwell Screech Owl because she's the one who first collected it.
Another person, and Elliot Cowes, who was there are many eccentrics who are part of this history that we're talking about. He's clearly one of them.
Yes, and in
Scott,
fact, Cowes was actually one of Maxwell's mentors. Cowes was as many of the 19th century. Century ornithologist. He was an army officer because you could collect safely from the confines of a fort. He was an idiosyncratic.
Does it probably help deal with boredom? I would think too.
Exactly. You know, you're stuck out there. You're either being attacked by Indians or you're trying to pass the time. And so many army officers, particularly medical officers, became collectors for Spencer Fullerton Baird, who was the secretary of the Smithsonian and the founder of the Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. So yes, you had Cowes, who was wonderfully contradictory. He had a, what shall we say, a difficult relationship with women, including his three wives.
Yes.
And he was a flagrant womanizer and something of a misogynist. And yet, he also was an early proponent for women's rights. Lost his teaching job at what later became Columbia University because of that. Was as I said, an early advocate for women ornithologists like Martha Maxwell, people like Mabel Osgood Wright, who was one of the founders of the modern Audubon movement. As I said to you just a moment ago, there were a lot of layers to the onion that was Elliot Cowes.
he talked about opera glass fiends.
Oh yes,
who is he referring to?
Well,
there?
He was talking about the Audubonians, as he put it. Is here again? I mean, he helped many of the women who founded the modern Audubon movement, but he had a great disdain for people who only wanted to watch birds. To Cowes, ornithological wisdom flowed from the muzzle of a shotgun, and in one of his last books, he was giving young ornithologists direction on how to build their collection. And he said, he rhetorically asked the question, well, how many birds should you collect? And he said, as many as you can shoot. Oh. A good day would be 50 birds shot, stuffed and all the data recorded, that you should have, you know, multiple specimens from multiple species. And this was at a time when you know, the balance was starting to shift toward birding as a hobby rather than ornithology as a science. And more people were aghast at the idea of just anybody going out with a shotgun and killing hundreds of birds for their own personal collection.
Well, you say by the end of the 19th century, the bird population had declined dramatically, I guess because of sport, food, I would assume, but also millinery.
That's right. It was mostly market hunting. Frankly, it was not scientific collecting that was driving this. It was people shooting birds for sale for the market, for the meat market. You could have gone to any market here in Philadelphia or any upscale hotel and found bobolinks and robins and shorebirds of two dozen or more species on the menu. And also, as you say, for fashion. If it flew, it died and somebody put it on a hat.
Wow.
Now, most of the birds that were being shot from the millinery trade were seabirds like gulls and terns, but particularly wading birds like egrets and herons, because in the springtime, they develop these long, filmy back feathers called egretes that are just so delicate and almost lighter than air and were worth twice their weight in gold. And so hundreds of millions of birds a year were being shot for the millinery trade by the end of the 1800s, and it really was quite a crisis for bird conservation.
Well, we're barreling through some of this history here. I do want to get to our callers, but I guess then, because of the bird decline, what you see then is the rise of things like the ornithological societies, or specifically, I guess, the Audubon Society.
That's right. And actually, there were two Audubon societies. Interestingly, the first was founded in 1886 by a man serendipitously named George Bird Grinnell, who had been a student of John James Audubon's widow Lucy when he was a young man. He was a prominent conservationist, and he created the first Audubon Society specifically to try to stop the feather trade. And it failed. And so he kind of, you know, took his ball and went home. And about 10 years later, women in Boston, particularly a woman named Harriet Hemingway, who sat at the absolute apex of Boston society, created the second Audubon movement. And they were able to tap into this women's club movement that had gained strength in the late 1800s, women fighting for universal suffrage, fighting against poverty, fighting for temperance. And they were able to say to these women, look, if you're going to wear the feathers of these innocent birds on your head, you're robbing yourself of the moral high ground. And within a very short time, they created this robust Audubon Society that remains today, and also held the feet of legislators to the fire and created many of the landmark bird protection laws that remain on the books today, like the Migratory Bird Protection Act in 1814, which remains the sort of the bedrock protection for most wild birds.
Let me put out another name. Florence Merriam wrote a book called Birds Through an Opera Glass, I guess, speaking of opera glasses, right? And this was the first field guide.
You could make an argument that it was. Florence Merriam came out with this book in the 1880s. She was a recent college graduate, quite a young woman, was writing articles for Bird Lore magazine about birding. And this was the first time that somebody had written a book that was dedicated to the idea of helping people, the average person, not a scientist, the average person identify live birds in the field using, well, they're not really binoculars because, you know, opera glasses leave a lot to be desired.
Yes, they
do. It was the first time somebody wrote a book that wasn't predicated on the idea of having a dead bird in the hand to identify first. Now, it was a long time before we finally got the first fully functional, usable field guide in 1934 when Roger Torrey Peterson published his. But Merriam's was one of those early progenitors of the modern field guide.
And I guess binoculars have transformed bird watching.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, even through about World War II, it was difficult to get a good pair of binoculars at a reasonable price. Most of them were made in Europe. But after World War II, the market was flooded with relatively inexpensive binoculars. It became easier to move around the country. And that combination of better optics and better mobility and also having a good field guide so you could identify what you're seeing just really, you know, put the pedal to the metal for birding.
Let me reintroduce you, and I do want to get callers in the conversation. We've been shoehorning some of this history of birding in our show today, Radio Times. And Scott Weidenthal has written a book about the history of American birding, and it's called Of a Feather. He's also the author of a number of books about the natural world world and about birding, including Return to Wild America, The Ghost with Trembling Wing, Living on the Wind, and that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and Mountains of the Harp. He's also a bird bander, and he lives in the rural part of Pennsylvania in the Appalachians. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions about this history we've been talking about or about birding today? We do want to get you in on our conversation. And we've got George from Morristown joining us. Hi, George. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Just a quick opening statement and then a fast question.
Sure.
I grew up in Wisconsin and had the great pleasure as a kid of being on the Mississippi Flyway and going to the Horicon National Wildlife Refuge and seeing millions of Canada geese. It was quite a sight out there. But here's my question for
sure.
you. In the springtime as a kid on the lake that we were on, emerging through the fog and the mist, sort of a romantic notion of looking out every spring, we would I couldn't remember if it was one or two Whistler swans, big swans in the middle of the lake, very solitary birds. I was wondering if you could comment on the status of that species these days, and then I'll hang up and listen for your answer.
George, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Scott.
Sure. Those what we used to call whistling swans, are actually today they're known as tundra swans, and they breed all across the Arctic through Canada and Alaska and actually over into parts of Siberia. And that whole population, well, the majority of that population comes east and winters here on the East Coast. Down in the Chesapeake Bay and on down through the Outer Banks. And in fact, a big part of that population stages up in its northbound migration every year at the Middle Creek Wildlife Management Area in Lancaster and Lebanon counties here in Pennsylvania. You can see as many as 30,000 of those
really?
Swans. You think two of those swans are impressive to see, George. You need to see 30,000 of them all at once. They're actually doing fairly well at this point. Their population is much greater than it was, although this is one of those species that we talked about at the top of the show, that because they nest in the Arctic, they're going to be kind of in the sights for climate change. Arctic nesting species, you know, they've gone about as far north as they can go, and as the climate warms, there's some real concern about what's going to happen to species like the tundra swan.
And just to follow up on that, by going north but finding that the habitat that they've depended on is not there, does that mean that they wouldn't survive the winter, or they have to figure out where else they're going to?
Well, it's not so much a question of winter survival. They're doing fine in the winter. It's just that, I mean, they are known as the tundra swan because
right.
they breed on ponds and lakes and marshes in the tundra, and the tundra is inevitably, the tundra zone in the Arctic is inevitably going to shrink as the forested zone moves further and further north, and the forest brings with it predators that these birds are able to escape by being out in the tundra. So it's as much a safety issue as anything else.
Let me get to Mary from North Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Mary. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, thanks
Hi there.
For taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I just wanted to ask you a question. I think it's kind of complicated about wind energy and how that plays into endangered species and, you know, avian issues. I know I've heard a lot about wind energy being such a good thing for the nation and getting renewable energy on our electricity grid. But I also hear a lot from opponents who say you're going to kill the birds and that kind of thing. I know not wind energy shouldn't be cited anywhere and everywhere, but at the same time, is there something to be said, or what do you think about something to be said to the fact that if we don't do wind energy or we don't put solar power up or something that might adversely affect these birds, won't they all die? Won't we all be in a much worse situation?
No, Mary, it's a great question, and we actually had some people on the show yesterday talking about energy independence, and we talked about wind energy. So, Scott, I'm interested in how you see that.
Well, it's as she said, it's an enormously complicated question, and she put her finger on it. I mean, it comes down to location, location, location. There are appropriate places to put wind developments, and there are inappropriate places. One of the places that worries me the most are the ridges of the Appalachians here in Pennsylvania, Maryland, West Virginia. This is one of the great migratory flyways in the world. You know, tens of thousands of raptors passing south. I mean, just millions and millions of songbirds. And many of these birds are flying within, you know, 500 or 600 feet of the ground at night, and mm-hmm. we're putting up these enormous structures right in their flyway, lighted with, you know, with glowing strobe lights, which we know from communication tower studies can disorient and attract birds. We know that the wind turbines can also be deadly to bats, as many as 4,000 dead bats at a single wind site in West Virginia. So we need to be very smart about where we're putting these. And what worries me tremendously is that we're rushing headlong into another big industrial-scale energy development without really thinking it through. This is something I've been involved with through Audubon, Pennsylvania for a very, very long time, and we've been urging the wind industry to do not just what I would consider to be fairly sketchy pre-construction monitoring, but to actually do a suitability assessment of each site, to spend several years looking at the migration in that area, because we don't really have good data site to site, and to be willing to accept adaptive management. So if they discover that there's a problem, they do whatever they can to mitigate that. And I really have not seen, unfortunately, very much in the way of flexibility or a willingness on the part of the wind industry to work with that. We keep hearing the same line that on average one dead bird per turbine per year, and
you don't buy it.
I don't, in part because I've seen the search protocols the mortality search protocols for many of these sites, and I'm not very impressed with them, and I'm unaware of any of these studies that have been published in peer reviewed scientific journals. It's mostly, you know, it's industry funded studies that the industry puts out on their own.
One of the counter arguments I've heard is that it's a matter of trade offs. That mm-hmm. that if we keep, you know, spewing fossil carbons into the air and creating this problem of climate change, you're going to, as you said, these birds are going to lose their habitat. So,
well, and even more directly than that, I don't like ripping the tops off mountains in Appalachia. I mean, that's I was talking about forest fragmentation mm-hmm. earlier, and mountaintop removal mining in the Appalachian Plateau region is a huge cause of habitat loss, not just for birds, but for a lot of other things, including the people who live there. What I'm suggesting is that we approach wind development a little bit more intelligently and mm-hmm. less of there's been kind of a land rush mentality as far as wind development goes, in particularly in the central Appalachians region in the last couple
of
years.
And what do you think about in Nantucket Sound?
In Nantucket Sound, one of the only times that there has been a serious multi-year study on its impacts on birds. Now, it wasn't done by the wind developers. It was done by Massachusetts Audubon. And they concluded that there are serious concerns because mm-hmm. Nantucket Sound hosts as many as a million wintering sea ducks, tens of millions of migrating songbirds that pass over it. Mass Audubon said they felt that the project could go forward with several important caveats, including the requirement that the developer undertake what I said before about adaptive management, meaning up to and including shutting the site down if nothing else solves the problem. So, I mean, that's a pretty significant caveat. And I think if most wind sites were developed with that kind of rigor beforehand and with that kind of caveat afterwards, I'd be a lot more comfortable with it.
Take that and compare it to the effect of cat ownership in the U.S. or tall buildings, tall glass buildings. When you look at some of the threats to
sure.
birds,
well, and in fact, that's one of the arguments that wind developers have often said. It's like, we're not killing as many birds as cats. We're not killing as many birds as windows. But you have to remember, all of these mortalities are cumulative. Because you put up a wind turbine doesn't mean that cats are killing fewer birds. And the
you're
numbers.
It's one more,
and that's
threat.
What we talked before about. Many of what had previously been common species of birds are in decline, and a lot of it is being driven by all of these death by a thousand cuts, all of these mortality issues. And when you start talking about putting up major wind development sites in places like off Galveston, anywhere along the Gulf Coast, which is one of the major migratory routes for birds coming into North America from the Neotropics, off the New Jersey coast and the Delaware coast, mm-hmm. where you have 1.5 million seabirds migrating within sight of land within the zone where these turbines are going to be built. We don't really have I remain unpersuaded by many of the studies suggesting that there is not much of a mortality impact on these birds. I would be happy to be proven wrong. I'm just saying, please show me the science.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Scott Wiedenthal, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a naturalist, a birder, a bird bander, and he's a writer, and he's got a new book. It's called Of a Feather, and it's a short history of American birding. We got just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments about what we've been talking about, whether it's some of the contemporary threats against our bird friends or some of the history we've been talking about, stay with us. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Penn State's Professional Development and Counseling Series supports WHYY, offering year-round classes for counselors, psychologists, and social workers. Classes in Philadelphia start November 2nd. Details at outreach.psu.edu/counseling.
U.S. Artists American Fine Art Show supports WHYY. From October 19th through 21st, more than 5,000 paintings, sculptures, and works on paper from 55 exhibitors will be on display and for purchase at the 33rd Street Armory. Produced by the Women's Board and presented by Pitcairn, U.S. Artists benefits the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Tickets at www.usartists.org.
This week, the band Radiohead made headlines by allowing their fans to download their new album In Rainbows through their website for whatever price listeners deem fair, all without the aid of a record label. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with Radiohead's leader, Tom York. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Supporting WHYY Focus Features, presenting the new espionage film Lust, Caution, from Ang Lee, the Academy Award-winning director of Brokeback Mountain. Lust, Caution, now in select theaters.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Scott Wiedenthal today on Radio Times about birding and windmills and cats and tall glass buildings, and taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Jim from Westchester to join us. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yes, Scott. The controversy that has erupted recently involves whether we should still shoot birds that are, we find new. There's probably one or two or three new species of birds discovered each year now, mainly in the tropics, and there have been instances where presumably it appears that the people who first discovered them would shoot two or three or four without ever knowing whether that was the only ones there, or whether the population was 12 or 1,200 or 12,000. And it seems like many in the ornithological community have coalesced to saying, yeah, we still need to shoot them, we need the specimens, whereas others, and I'm in the other category, saying, well, with DNA and the photographs, et cetera, there's really no need to kill them. If you find out that there's 10 million of them, that's fine. But if you find out that the population is 60 and you kill four, that's a pretty big percentage.
Well, Jim,
what's your take on that?
I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Scott Wiedenthal.
Well, for background, for those who might not be familiar with this, you know, traditionally in science, when a new species is discovered, whether it's a bird or a plant or whatever, you collect a specimen, and that's known as the type specimen. That is the specimen from which the species is described for science. The first formal written description is prepared, and the specimen has to be available for scientific study, so that if somebody else, if you say, well, I found a new bird in the forests of South America, and here's my written description, but I let the bird go, there can, you know, there, I think everybody can understand that there'd be some doubt as to, you know, somebody comes back and says, well, I think perhaps it's, you know, a subspecies of whatever. As Jim said, in recent years, there have been a few cases where scientists have found what they believe was a new species of birds, photographed it, videotaped it, made audio recordings of its vocalizations if possible, and then instead of killing one of them as the type specimen, took a feather, I believe in one case, a feather sample and a blood sample for DNA, and released the bird because they were dealing with what they believed to be a very small population, which may be endangered. That's a laudable thing. I'm not quite sure that we're there yet, where that's going to replace type specimens. And also, I think it's important to remember that, you know, the natural mortality these birds face is extraordinary, and that unless you're talking about, as you say, a population of maybe 12 birds, the loss of a single individual probably in the long run is not going to make that much difference. I laud the scientists who did this for being cautious, but I don't think it's necessary for us to see a wholesale turn in that direction. I mean, scientific collecting still goes on at a very much reduced rate. Most of the specimens that come into scientific collections today are birds that died from other causes. I know the Academy of Natural Sciences here, picks up birds that collide with skyscrapers here in Center City, Philadelphia, and that's where they get most of their specimens from. But if you're doing ornithological work in a remote part of the world, in areas where the bird life has been relatively little studied, that loss of a handful of individuals for the vast majority of bird species is outweighed, I think, by the benefit to science.
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Is he right when he says new species are discovered every year?
Oh yes, still a handful, not like it was in the golden age of ornithology in the 19th and early 20th century, and almost all of them in the tropics, but not entirely. I mean, just within the last 10 years, a new species of bird was described here in North America. It's called Gunnison sage grouse. It's a big bird. These males weigh
Where's
like 8 or 10. Well, it's always been there in this part of southwestern Colorado and northern Utah. It was overlooked. It's a unique species of bird that looks very much like the much wider spread greater sage grouse. So most of the new species that are being described today are what are known as cryptic species. They've just been overlooked. But some, that Shangri-La Valley that was discovered in New Guinea this past winter, where there were many new species of birds and frogs and mammals, there are still isolated parts of the world and still areas where the birds haven't been studied well enough that there are surprises waiting for us.
Do you have your list of birds that you've seen?
I keep a life list. Yeah, I couldn't tell you probably within 75 or 100 species how many are on there. Some birders are very focused on their list.
Yes, they
are. It becomes very competitive.
Yes, they are.
They're competitive against each other. They're competitive against themselves. There's nothing wrong with that. What worries me, and this is something I talk about in the book and have been beaten up a little bit for by some of my birding friends, is I think sometimes that modern birding is too list focused. We're too focused on birds as inventory, that it's just another tick mark on your life list, and once you've seen it, it doesn't matter anymore.
Then you're on to your next bird,
and then you're on to the next one. And I love going to a new area where I haven't seen birds. I love the thrill of particularly finding it on my own. I love the thrill of finding a bird that's way out of range. I walked out of my house one day a few years ago and found a white-winged dove from the southwest sitting on the telephone wire. But birding today has become so focused on rarities and building up a big list that I think some birders, by no means all, but some birders have lost the sight of the bigger picture, which is the bird itself.
Well, in fact, you say the birders need to do more to think about conservation, I guess, and habitat conservation and preserving the environment for birds.
And I think you'll rarely find another group of people that are as ecologically literate as birders. They understand the issues. What I'm saying is that we need to mobilize and we need more activism. You know, I've been a hunter and angler all my life, and sportsmen have had it drummed into their head from birth that conservation is expensive, and you have to pay for conservation. And they do. And so they have self-imposed excise taxes on fishing tackle and sporting arms and ammunition, and all that money goes back into wildlife conservation at the state level. Attempts to try to get birders to do the same thing have really failed.
That's interesting.
Well, I mean, part of it is there's been a tremendous amount of opposition from the retail end of things, you know, the L.L. Beans of the world, who don't want to add 10 or 12% to the cost of a pair of binoculars or a backpack or a field guide or a pound of bird seed. But if there are 81 million people in America who care about birds, as we are told, and even a tenth of them picked up the phone and called their congressman, we'd have this passed tomorrow. You know, the only way we are going to have birds to enjoy in the future is to stand up right now and become active.
Do what anglers and hunters have done, you're
absolutely,
saying.
Absolutely. My good friend Ken Kaufman, who's one of the top birders in the world today, a man for whom I have a great deal of respect, has said only partially with tongue-in-cheek that maybe the way to approach this is that you shouldn't be able to count a bird on your life list until you have done something concrete to help that species. Whether it's, you know, making a donation or writing a letter or just doing something. And in that way, connect the sport of bird watching, the sport of birding and listing with the conservation of birds. And, you know, I'm not trying to make a blanket statement. There are many birders who are doing wonderful things for bird conservation, but it needs to become more of a universal ethos.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got Andy from Claymont, Delaware. Hi, Andy. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yes. I just wanted to say it's amazing to me that with that many people interested in birds and birding, that there is no television show devoted to birding. And because it cuts across demographic lines, you'd think there'd be a big advertising opportunity there because of ecotourism and optical companies and you know, it would be endless. And there, even on cable, Animal Planet, there really is no birding program on, and it's just amazing to me.
Do you find yourself amazed as well, Scott?
Well,
thanks, Andy.
I am and I'm not. Actually, there have been some in the past. Don and Lillian Stokes, who are two very prominent birders, have a long-running birding show. Ken Kaufman, who I just mentioned a moment ago, is going to be doing a birding show with his wife. I believe that's already in production. But, you know, I think part of it is birding tends to be a relatively low-key, relatively frequently solitary hobby.
And I was thinking, what would the show be about? You know,
well,
I'm trying to imagine.
And that's what I'm trying to think as well. And that's one of the issues that the people who've tried to create birding shows in the past have struggled with. And what usually ends up happening is it's sort of a celebrity birder host going to a hot birding area. One of the struggles for the crew doing that is that it's very difficult to get good film footage of birds. And birds don't like to be photographed. They don't like you walking up with television cameras and boom microphones and the rest of it. And so there's some logistical challenges there as well.
Does that focus, from your perspective, too much on the exotic as opposed to the sort of common everydayness of bird watching?
That could well be as well. I mean, that's why I think that Animal Planet and all of these other cable shows that focus on wildlife, you know, sort of give us that fix. If somebody were to do a birding show about birding with me, it would be pretty boring. Oh, look, he's getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and going out in his backyard again. Oh, look,
he's putting on those funny shorts that he wears, right?
No, I hope that we can
get past those horrible stereotypes. I'm sorry.
No,
I apologize.
It's true, but you know, the fact of the matter is, and I talk about this in the book, you know, birders tend to be a rather practical group of people. And every summer I teach several courses in ornithology along the Maine coast at an Audubon center up on a beautiful island in the Maine coast. And I look around at the 30 or 40 people in the field with me, and we're all wearing dull earth tones, and we're wearing big floppy hats to keep the rain out of our eyes. We're just very practically. I mean, there's always a few people who have their pants legs tucked into their socks because they come from parts of the country where ticks are a problem. And well, no wonder people think we're dweebs. Good God, look at the way we dress. I'm as guilty of that as the next person.
Hey, some of my best friends are birders. Let me get Seth from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Seth. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I actually had a question. We're talking, just to play devil's advocate, I don't necessarily believe this, but you've been talking a lot about saving endangered birds and dangers on flyways with wind power and cats and skyscrapers, but my question is more along the lines of natural selection. Couldn't this be seen as a way of weeding out those that aren't adapting? I mean, if we're changing the environment, isn't that, you know, changing Sure. what these birds have to live with?
Well, yeah, I guess you could take that argument and that absolves us of any responsibility to the natural world at all, because I hear this argument all the time that, well, if they can't adopt, then nature intends them to become extinct. I look at for example migratory songbirds. I mean, virtually all the birds that migrate do so primarily after dark. For tens of millions of years, these birds have been flying through dark skies with no real obstacles, and then all of a sudden, within the space of just a couple of human generations, which is less than an eye blink in geologic time, you know, we've washed out the night sky with light pollution. We've We've put up, you know, lighted skyscrapers and communication towers and wind turbines and all these other obstacles through the night sky. What we're supposed to argue that these birds need to suddenly, you know, rapidly evolve.
Get with the program.
Yeah,
right?
Get with the program. You know, evolve, you know, gigantic eyes so that they can see in the dark and an aversion to light. Whereas for millions of years they've been navigating by starlight, and now suddenly you have these brilliant strobe lights at night that disorient them. That's asking an awful lot. And I realize that the caller's playing devil's advocate and doesn't really support this. But, you know, I hear this all the time, and it's such a cop-out. I mean, that's like saying, well, you know, if your kid can't learn not to walk out into traffic at age two, well, then he doesn't belong in the gene pool.
But do you think there's a point at which birds would begin to adapt to the environment that we have changed?
They certainly have, and they already are. I mean, we're seeing changes. Birds in urban areas, for example, sing louder and sometimes at different frequencies than birds in quieter areas because they're trying desperately to be heard over the cacophony of noise. You know, birds are adapting to an extent to changing climate. Migratory birds are arriving as much as 2 weeks earlier in the north in the spring as they did 40 or 50 years ago, leaving as much as 2 weeks later in the fall. You know, but there are limits to how rapidly, and of course, as with climate change, it's the rapidity of the change as much as anything else that's the real problem here. There's a limit to how fast any organism can evolve.
Hey, Seth, thanks for the call. Let me get Beth from Lehigh Valley to join us. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I love this topic today. I've been a birder all my life, and I was born and raised in a rural area. And this is my problem. As a backyard birder, and I have a great backyard for birds, my neighbor's cats are constantly coming through my yard. Drives me crazy. I have two dogs. There are dog laws that stop me from allowing my dogs to run rampant through the neighborhood. Do you know of any municipality that has ever passed a cat law? I don't understand, and I'm not a cat hater, but I don't understand how people can just let their domestic cats out in the morning to do whatever it is they're going to do all day long, and then call them in at night after they've killed every baby bird in my yard.
I know. Believe me.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott. Thanks, Beth.
I really feel for you. My wife and I live in a rural area about 2 hours northwest of the city, and our problem up there is, you know, barn cats, people dumping cats out and feral cats running around. You know, to answer your question, yes, there is one municipality in suburban Baltimore that has passed exactly the kind of cat ordinance that you're talking about that makes it a crime to let cats run. You know, we're kind of at the place with cats today that we were with dogs 30 years ago. When I was growing up, everybody let their dog run loose. And we had a real problem with dogs running deer up in the mountains and packs of feral dogs because people were dumping them out there. That's not socially acceptable today. It's not legal today. And I think that with time, we're going to see the same kind of change that we saw with dog laws and, you know, and what we're seeing with cigarette smoking, where it's becoming less and less socially acceptable to smoke cigarettes around other people. I suspect if we have this conversation 20 years from now, you know, people will be aghast at the idea of anyone letting their cat run outside. And, you know, and I feel like I have to make this perform a statement that I love cats. I have had pet cats. I am not a cat
hater. We're
going to
give out your email address.
I know.
Really get
this
you
is not
trouble.
A reflection on cats. It's a reflection on the people who own cats. Right. There's a reason they're called house cats, people. It's healthier for the cat to keep them inside, and it doesn't matter if you put a bell on your cat, it doesn't matter how well you feed your cat. If you've ever dragged a ball of yarn in front of a cat, they're attracted to movement and they pounce and they kill tremendous numbers of birds. By some estimates, as many as 250 million birds a year just in the state of Wisconsin. You start extrapolating that nationwide, you're talking about billions and billions of birds. And, you know, here's one of those mortality causes that is completely preventable.
Well, on that note, and as always, Scott Weidenthal, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure, as always, Marty. Thank
and
you.
He's got a new book. It's called Of a Feather, and it's a short history of American birding. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Devorah Lissick is the producer of the program. Alan Tu and Susan Greenbaum are the senior producers of Radio Times. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition. Also, our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email. Find out about podcasts and years of archived programs there as well. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.